The show goes on. This is the official show on the Fish on First podcast channel with me, Eli Sussman, the managing editor of Fish Stripes, where we cover your Miami Marlins every day in our own way. As you can imagine, this is a ton of fun to do when the team is in playoff position this deep into the season, ahead of teams that were more heavily favored, more heavily invested in 2023, and instead it's the Marlins who are slightly above 500 entering Thursday. This episode is going to transverse the aging curve in baseball. We're going to have later in the show, be sure to stick around to the end, I have an exclusive interview with Marlins right-hander Carson Milbrandt. If that name doesn't ring a bell, they just drafted this guy in last year's draft, third round pick, 19 years old just now in his first full professional season. And for the YouTube audience, we appreciate people that tune in that way. I've chopped that up into a separate video. So be sure to watch this one first, then go over to that interview. For the podcast folks, it's all in one right here for you. Be sure you're subscribing to Fish Stripes wherever you get your podcasts to get the official show, as well as all of our other audio offerings, including Fish Stripes Unfiltered coming up with Tommy Hutton and State of the Fish coming up every week, occasional episodes of What a Relief, Fishology, and yes, more of this program that I do on my own. First, before we get to Carson, I'm checking in on veteran players who could be on their way out of Miami before Milbrandt even makes it to the show. Maybe guys that are on their way out of baseball entirely later this year, the potential pending free agents on the Miami Marlins, because there are quite a bit of them for this team as we head into the 2023 season. So I know you're thinking that it's a little premature to already be looking ahead to the offseason. And that's because there are a bunch of guys in this situation, so many so that the Marlins are going to have to make some decisions even during the year as it's going on. So one way of looking at it is, things are jiving so well. Will the Marlins spend what it takes to keep this group together, even when they have so many players that are coming up on the ability to reach the open market? Or because they have some players in that situation that are actually underperforming, will this team be kind of antsy to make changes, be willing to cut bait with some of these players that are almost done with their deals anyway, in order to bring up more promising young players to supplant those pending free agents as the season goes on?
That's an interesting question.
It's been talked about a lot.
That's an interesting question.
One way or another, this is a very unfamiliar position for the Marlins. They usually don't have many players that are still with the organization deep into their 30s. Heading into contract years, usually these players are frequently traded by the team even before this year even starts. But because this team is in a unique position, as we've covered entering the year with a lot of urgency to field a more competitive team, we're in this situation where, I think any way you slice it, there's going to be quite a bit of roster turnover between now and 2024. And it's not too soon to look at the way that these guys are performing relative to expectations and start playing, you know, in the mind of a GM as to whether or not they have a chance to actually stick around through the rest of 2023 and beyond. Stick with me here on the official show, other side of the break, as we'll be diving into seven different names of potential pending Marlins free agents. And just sizing up exactly what we've seen from them so far, how they could fit in or not fit in with this Marlins organization moving forward. Stick with me. Two distinct groups we have here. We have the unrestricted free agents, the ones that very clear cut, have enough major league service time so that after the season, in their last years of their deals, once those deals expire, they simply hit the open market as things are currently drawn up in their contract, pending any sort of extension or potentially getting cut before the offseason begins. Yeah, these are players there that are simply headed in that direction. Later on in just a few minutes, we'll cover the guys that have contract options for 2024, the ones that are still, it's unclear whether or not they'll be on the market or not heading into this upcoming winter. On the unrestricted free agent side, let's start with Garrett Cooper. So Cooper, very familiar name to Marlins fans. This is already his sixth season in the organization. Even though he hasn't been on the field a whole lot, he's been in the major leagues or on the major league injured list for much of the last 6 years. And that's why by the end of this year, he'll have the sufficient service time to become a free agent. These stats are drawn from entering Wednesday, so not including this most recent game. And with Cooper, all things considered, is relatively close to the player that he's been throughout his Marlins tenure. Not on the same all-star trajectory that he was last year, though if you remember last year, he really wasn't doing anything remarkable until the calendar flipped to June. Still some hope that the same thing could happen this year, that the overall numbers will look quite a bit prettier by the middle of the season or even by the end of the season with him. Entering Wednesday, he was hitting 280 with a weighted runs created plus of 105, a reminder that 100 is league average. And I guess what sticks out is the elevated strikeout rate and the pretty meager walk rate, which is well below his career norms. The main difference between his 2023 performance and his overall major league numbers is, yeah, he's just not getting on base quite as much as we're used to. The one defining trait of Cooper's major league career to this point that was probably gone under the radar is his really impeccable ability to get hits on balls in play. His BABIP is one of the highest in major league history. I'm going to say that again. One of the highest BABIPs in major league history among a player with as much playing time as he has.
From home plate.
And Garrett Cooper, right center, gets down and going to get to the wall. Two runs are in, and the Marlins take the lead in the ninth.
A wonderful comeback here in the ninth inning by the Marlins.
Garrett Cooper, two RBI double, has given the Marlins a 5-4 lead.
He has that really awesome, somewhat hard to put your finger on gift to just hit line drives to all parts of the field. He's a high floor player where health permitting, that's a huge caveat, when he is mostly healthy and he's in the lineup, he's going to get his hits and he's going to get a fair amount of doubles as well to go along with just the singles. But the over the fence power is kind of limited, and defensively at this stage of his career, he's first base only. Even at first base, it's not exactly an impactful glove over there. So with him, he has been no doubt a good value to the Marlins overall, considering that to this point in his career, I think his earnings are not even $10 million. He's been receiving kind of modest raises in arbitration year after year after year. Nothing too overwhelming for the team's perspective. And yet he's been every single year since 2019, he's been a well above average bat. And that alone has quite a bit of value. As I mentioned, he was an all-star in 2022, and that brought a lot of positive attention to the organization. It's been a nice tenure for him. He's been a nice role player. And the question is exactly what his market is going to look like. And so there's been a pretty interesting range of guesstimates as to what Cooper will potentially be commanding on the market. I think players like him, that when you see that he is going to be entering his age 33 season and with his pretty significant limitations as a base runner and a defender and the questions about his over the fence power, I think he's the kind of player, probably as much as anybody on this list, that I could see getting to free agency and actually drawing quite a bit of interest from multiple teams and yet still being in the price range that the Marlins can afford to bring him back. They don't necessarily have a successor at first base that is knocking down the door in the minor leagues. So it's not like they'll be eager to give the steering wheel to somebody else at that position. That's one where I think, this could wait until after the year to see exactly where things are going. And I wouldn't be surprised either way if he comes back. It's just so frustrating for him, more so than anybody else, the injury history, including this year, an inner ear infection keeping him out for almost 2 weeks right here already this season. So you just hope that it's a tough decision for everybody involved. You hope that he just stays healthy the rest of this year and puts up the kind of numbers that are as good, if not better, than what he's done at any other point in his career, because he's extremely talented. And this will be probably his his first and potentially his only opportunity to really cash in as a free agent in his career. Sharing a position with him this year, Yuli Gurriel, nearing his 39th birthday in just a few weeks. This season, his numbers have come back down to earth. Maybe kind of under the radar. He is back down to being essentially the player that he was last year with Houston. Entering Wednesday, he was hitting .247 with a .299 on base percentage, .382 slugging, WRC plus of 88. Overall performance right around replacement level for Yuli Gurriel. He was brought in as a minor league signing of the Marlins. I think what I'm going to do is, coming up in a little bit, I'll show you the more particular contract details when we get to the guys with options. With Gurriel, he's in the same boat as Cooper. He's an unrestricted free agent after this year. And the question is whether or not he makes it through the entire year. I think I had voiced this take in multiple places entering the season that I simply didn't see Yuli lasting all of 2023 on the Marlins active roster. The signs, the production that he had in 2022 with the Astros, I thought was reflective of who he is at this stage of his career. He's had a magnificent playing career if you include all of his time in Cuba. And certainly as recently as 2021, it was impressive when he won a batting title with the Astros and was still a very strong defensive first baseman. That's the one edge he has over Cooper and one reason why they complement each other nicely on this roster. Gurriel has had, I'd say, more good than bad defensively for the Marlins this year. He's been useful as a late game replacement on days where Cooper starts, and he's been useful spelling Cooper at times. He still hits for so much contact. That was the main appeal. That was the puzzle that the Marlins were putting together this offseason, bringing in a whole lot of high contact hitters to hopefully raise the floor of this team. He was one of them. Whereas Gene Segura still has another guaranteed year on his deal. Luis Arraez still has two more years under team control beyond 2023. Gurriel is the one in this position where it's year to year with him. And frankly, it's going to be month to month. So I'll just leave it at that with him, that as great as he's been at times throughout most of his Houston tenure, I still see the same player that was struggling with Houston in 2022, the same one that couldn't secure a guaranteed deal from any other team entering this year. Ultimately, signs with the Marlins a base salary of $1.25 million, I believe it is, for this year. Yeah, still go a little bit at a time with him. They're not going to rush him out the door unless there is another hitter at AAA that really shows that they belong in a role on the big league roster instead of Gurriel. He's been fine so far. I think the Marlins, he kind of is what they signed up to get. And for a player with his skill level and history, you don't want to put it past him to turn back the clock and figure something out. I'm just saying that the realistic expectation for at this point is that Gurriel's role gradually gets diminished over the course of this season. And I don't think you worry all that. You don't lose much sleep about him playing for somebody else or potentially calling a career altogether. Another unrestricted free agent, Joey Wendell, who is now the Marlins' primary shortstop. A bit of a questionable choice entering this year. And Wendell, he simply, I think by any standard, it's been a very disappointing start to his walk year. He wasn't hitting in spring training. He wasn't hitting on his minor league rehab assignment coming back from an intercostal strain. And so far, on the other side of that IL stint, there have been a couple really nice moments. There was that go-ahead hit in extra innings at Wrigley. There was the game-winning hit that put them ahead in Arizona. And aside from that, it's been few and far between offensively. He entered Wednesday with a 10 WRC plus. 10. Double digits. Barely in the double digits, I should say. And he wasn't starting Wednesday's game either. For somebody that they viewed as their primary shortstop entering the year, I think until he starts hitting, it's going to be more of a platoon situation where he probably doesn't start against any left-handed pitchers for the near-term future. And they need to hope that he hits against righties before really expanding the role back to what it was entering the season. The strikeout rate, the swing and miss, has been oddly prevalent. Wendell cut from the same cloth as Gurriel. That was the appeal why they acquired him the previous offseason, for his contact hitting, for his great situational hitting, his ability to use all fields. And this year, even though he's had those couple key extra base hits that I mentioned, the absence of simply putting his bat on the ball has been odd. That's been uncharacteristic of Wendell. At the very least, it's something that you feel is a solid piece of his skill set. Let's see if I could find his swinging strike rate so far this season. According to Fangraphs, to this point in the year, it is 12%. That would be far and away the worst of his career. It had never been higher than 10.7 in a major league season. It's still better than league average. It's just not enough for a player like him when you know that the power isn't really significant. As a base runner, he's not going to really steal very many bases for you. It's really marginal value that he adds in terms of getting extra bases taken on balls in play and making smart reads. But otherwise, they need him to be better, plain and simple, for this team to sustain where it is in the standings, considering that they don't have right at this moment, they have a lot of internal options that could play shortstop, but really no good solutions that you would think would be better than a prime Joey Wendell. If he shows he's still in the prime of his career, he's earning more money than Cooper and Gurriel this year via arbitration, a tick over $6 million. I think the Marlins actually agreed to a deal beforehand to avoid arbitration. If he stays, if it's more of what we saw over the last calendar year, where he struggled hitting offensively late last year too, it's not going to be a super large market for his services in the offseason. He's somebody that is, I think, under significant pressure to turn it around over these next few months for everybody's sake. They're relying quite a bit on Wendell moving forward. And I think I'll just leave it at that. One other player who is also an unrestricted free agent. So these are the guys that, barring an extension, will hit the open market after the 2023 campaign. We covered Cooper, covered Gurriel, Wendell, and finally Dylan Floro. Dylan Floro, who of that group is certainly the one that has been the best to this point in 2023. He has been true to his history. His pretty substantial track record now, where if he's healthy, he's getting a ton of ground balls. And even when balls are in the air, they're staying in the park. He is attacking the strike zone, and he is doing it in high leverage situations. He entered Wednesday at 2.95 ERA, 3.58 fielder independent pitching, 25% strikeout rate, only 5.5% walk rate in 18 and a third innings. There were a few saves in there, including one that he picked up again on Wednesday against the Nationals. He is the Marlins' primary closer, it seems, during the brief absence of AJ Puck, who's on the IL. This is now his third season with the Marlins, and really the only major blip we had is when he was coming back from a shoulder injury early last season. Overall, for much of those three seasons, he's been terrific. He's been a really good reliever for this Marlins team. This is a front office that has been, they've shown through their actions that they're not going to pay big money for any reliever under any circumstances. So they're not really sweating about the fact that Floro is going to be a free agent. At the same time, because of that philosophy, and because it finally does seem that there is a decent wave of relievers coming up through the organization on the minor league side, maybe they do make an exception with somebody like Floro, and he is somebody that they might consider paying a market rate to keep around for multiple years. Of this group, he is the one that I think is most clearly going to get a multi-year deal if he does reach the open market. We've seen it just this past offseason, players with lesser track records. Some of them have nastier pure stuff, but Floro is a unique reliever with the way that he has a deep pitch mix, a four pitch mix, and he's able to command those pitches. It leads to a lot of soft contact, a lot of ground balls. He's just really reliable in such a way that I would expect him to get a 2-year deal this upcoming offseason, somewhere north of $10 million over the course of those couple of years. With the Marlins go that far to keep him, I would lean towards probably not. But he's a guy that I'd see probably more so than anybody else as a mid-season extension candidate. The Marlins have given him more responsibility to pitch in those high leverage situations than he's gotten from other teams. And so far, really great here in 2023. I would think that there's some mutual interest in keeping him around. That has turned out pretty well. That trade to get him from the Dodgers in exchange for Alex Vesia and Kyle Hurt. It was a little bit of a roller coaster in the beginning, considering that the Dodgers are liking their end of that deal as well, for the most part. With Floro, yeah, this is somebody that I think they would miss as much as you could miss a single reliever, with somebody that gives you 60 innings a year. He's a standout guy. He is going to be, I would say, widely coveted by a lot of teams if he does, in fact, hit the open market this upcoming offseason. That covers the unrestricted free agents. Now, quickly to go through the guys that have options for 2024, contract options. I'll pull them up one by one. A reminder that this whole premise is kind of predicated on Jorge Soler. We haven't covered Soler yet because he is in this bucket. A player that, when he signed with the Marlins originally, a three-year, $36 million deal, but with opt-outs in between each year of that deal. After the 2022 season, considering that he spent the entire second half of that year on the IL with a back injury and that he didn't hit to his normal standards when he was even on the field, it was a fairly easy decision for Soler to stick around in 2023. And so far in 2023, this is somebody that we circled as a prime bounce-back candidate, a beneficiary of infield shifting being restricted. It has played out almost exactly the way that you would have wanted to for Soler to this point in the season. He was entering this Wednesday's game hitting .238 with a .317 OBP, .503 slugging. That's a .121 WRC plus, 21% better than league average. Those numbers got a little bit better because for the second straight day, he hit a bomb. And it wasn't a walk-off this time on Wednesday, but it was another important situation that put them ahead to stay for the rest of that game.
And sends this one into left center field toward AutoNation Alley. Another home run for Jorge Soler.
For somebody that I think even last year, even when he had some hot stretches, it would seem that a lot of his production came in low leverage situations. He was somebody you didn't necessarily love to have up against high quality pitching. This year, you need to give him some credit. You need to give him a lot of credit for being the player that the Marlins envisioned when they signed him to that deal coming off his World Series MVP. These are the contract details from Kotz Contracts on Baseball Prospectus. He's the highest paid Marlins player here in 2023, a $15 million salary. He once again has the opportunity to opt out after 2023. It's a player option. Next year, base salary, $9 million for Soler, but it does have these pretty substantial performance bonuses for plate appearances where he could get up to $4 million additional on that salary just by getting plate appearances next year, maxing out at 550 plate appearances and starting at 350. So basically half a season gets him the first $500,000 bonus. And then it tacks on from there with every 50 subsequent plate appearances. It's not as simple as saying, can he beat $9 million on the open market? It's taking into account that he's with a team that is playing him basically every single day, that to this point in the year, with only a few exceptions, has been willing to hand over the DH spot to him and allow him to sit there, even though it does restrict what they can do with the rest of the roster. Shows you how much they believe in his bat to be worthy of that, the high standard that comes with being a DH most of the time. So if he feels he's going to get that playing time here, and he's playing in one of the few teams in states with no income tax, that helps. You know, that's a factor when he's comparing the offers that he might potentially get on the open market from other teams. He has his offseason home in Miami as well. That was a factor bringing him in the first place. And that will need to be considered moving forward, I think. So when Craig Mish brought this up on Twitter, kind of under the assumption that Soler will be opting out of his deal because he has gone back to who he used to be. My initial gut feel was that it's possible. I'd give it slightly better than a coin flip chance that he opts out. I put it at 55%. This was last week. And since then, he's continued to be very productive, basically swinging this Nationals Marlins series single-handedly. It's not an overstatement to say that he has won them. He won one Tuesday's game basically all by himself and had a huge hand in Wednesday's as well. That he's not really showing any signs of cooling off. His batted ball quality is extraordinary. How frequently he's barreling the ball. That's the stuff that does generally pay in free agency. Even if you are going to be in your age 32 season, even if you are going to be pretty heavily used at DH, I think Skip Schumacher even specified that they're not comfortable using him more than one day in a row on defense. So that just shows you, even more so than Garrett Cooper, you could say, he's limited as to what he adds in that aspect of the game just because of all the steps they're taking to make sure that his back issues are not flaring up because of the way that he's used. So with Soler, this is going to take a while to play out. As we move along, I get slightly, I see it as a likely possibility that he does test the open market, but it's not a foregone conclusion. Needs to stay healthy, needs to continue to be available as a defender on occasion when his team needs that spot opened up to give somebody else a half day off. In the meantime, the Marlins are thrilled with the production that Soler is giving them. And his status, I think, will be partially affected by how these other corner outfielders perform the rest of this year. When Jesus Sanchez is healthy, how much does Brian De La Cruz stay on his hot streaks? And whether Peyton Burdick proves that he is a viable major leaguer as well. They feel good enough about those younger pre-arbitration players and feel that they can sort of emulate his production or come somewhere close to it. Then it's easier to let Soler walk. But that's going to be a fascinating storyline to follow the rest of the season. Sticking with two others that have options as well. That was a player option for Soler. With a club option, there's Matt Barnes, acquired in that trade from the Boston Red Sox in a deal where they made it cash neutral. His salary was higher for 2023 than Richard Blyer was. The Red Sox threw in money to even it up. Yeah, the Red Sox paying the majority of the money that was left on his contract at the time of the deal. And the club option for next year, $8 million with a $2.25 million buyout on Barnes. So with him, his performance this year has been fine. I noticed that the fastball velocity was down early in the year. That has gone back up to an appropriate level for somebody of his pitching style. Still, I don't see the strikeouts coming back to what they used to be. He's somebody that is going to have to rely on pitching to contact more than he's accustomed to. Yet this year, his strikeout rate is 21.3%, slightly lower than the major league average and well below the major league average for relievers. A 3.78 ERA, 4.38 FIP. He is, at this point, a run-of-the-mill middle reliever for a team right now. Run-of-the-mill middle reliever is not going to be somebody that you pay $8 million to in 2024. I think that's highly probable that they end up declining that club option. But so far, fitting in pretty well with this Marlins clubhouse. We saw that firsthand when he appeared on What a Relief on the same Fish on First podcast channel. You can listen back to see that conversation with him. Yeah, he's an asset to the organization, just not one that is commensurate with the terms of his contract and his club option for 2024. I think there's a pretty good chance that Barnes is a one and done with this Marlins organization. And finally, it's also a club option. The player here that has fallen the farthest short of what the Marlins expected of him this year has to be Johnny Cueto, signed to a 1 year, $8.5 million deal in the offseason, $6 million of that paid out this season, and then $2.5 million his club option for next year. I had forgotten about all these performance bonuses that if he was mostly healthy, whether as a starter or as a reliever, the Marlins were going to chip on some extra money in here. $50,000 for 25 starts and $75,000 if he reaches 28 starts. Even that lowest threshold is completely out of reach now due to subsequent injuries, back-to-back injuries, or I should say kind of concurrent injuries. First the biceps issue, then the ankle issue when he was rehabbing the biceps issue at AAA with him. He's pitched one game for the Marlins, one injury-shortened game. You can't even guarantee that there's going to be a second game at this point because he's still far away from getting back from the ankle issue. It just, you know, the reading between the lines, the team is just disappointed in Cueto and how it just didn't seem that he prepared for this season with the same type of work ethic that he had in his previous seasons. At 37 years old, maybe he was just not as motivated to get ready as he was earlier in his career before he had really established himself. And for a team that even now, and certainly at this point, has very little margin for error with their starting pitching situation because of the number of guys that went down due to injuries. They thought Cueto, coming off the year that he had in Chicago, would be a reliable workhorse for them. Not a star pitcher by any means, just somebody that would be available for them, somebody that would be able to share some best practices with the younger pitchers in this organization. And that has just not panned out whatsoever for him. So this one trending towards being a bust at this point. You have to wonder, at least in the near term, the simple solution is going to be moving him to the 60-day injured list to keep him off the 40-man roster. And are we sure he's going to make his way back onto the 40-man before the end of the year? Or are they going to reach a point where they just don't believe in his ability to contribute to the team and maybe they just cut their losses before we even get to the end of 2023? It's been an unfortunate turn of events for him because there was a lot of enthusiasm for Cueto and for everything that he brings, for the track record he brings, and for the swag that he brings. And it just has been a bust for him with this Marlins team in 2023. So as we covered all these guys, aside from Soler and Floro have been the ones that have been stars and critical pieces of this team so far in 2023, and everybody else somewhere on that spectrum from being useless to being just a run-of-the-mill role player. I think it's safe to assume that several of these players won't be back in 2023. And really the bigger question is exactly whether they make it through the year and how the Marlins go about transitioning players of more long-term control into these prominent roles as the season goes on, in case these guys get hurt or in case they struggle, and potentially whether this is a team, even if they're in contention midway through the year, and certainly if they fall out of contention, you have to look at some of these players as trade candidates in order to salvage something. As positive as things are going in the win column for the Marlins in 2023, well, I mean, they're still looking down to the farm system. This is still not a really deep organization. This is one that still needs to do things to ensure that they have a sustainable future, that they have waves of talent coming up through the organization. It's a thin organization, even as there are some star players on the major league roster that you're really excited about. And that's why some of these decisions probably can't wait until the offseason. They need to be really open and potentially aggressive in terms of initiating extension talks of players that they think are important to the team's future. I personally, if they could get Dylan Floro at a reasonable deal, a slightly below market deal somehow, if it's like 2 years with a club option for 2026 and the guarantee is in the $10 million range or maybe slightly above that, I think that's something that the team should consider and get out in front of. And Soler, that's going to be a tricky one in terms of what exactly he's looking for. It does make me worry about committing to somebody that is mostly a DH and who potentially will always be a DH moving forward, that just really limits what you can do with the rest of your roster, and it puts so much pressure on him to perform exactly the way he is right now in terms of both overall production and high leverage production with him. So that's one where I can imagine it's probably going to wait until after the season and with the Marlins getting an inside track in order to re-sign him for 2024 and beyond. So I hope you appreciated this overview here on the official show. I'm going to have a separate video with my interview with Carson Milbrandt. Really good conversation with him. And because of some of the audio recording of it, not all of it was publishable in video and audio form for you guys. Instead, I'm going to be sure to write up the complete transcripts that between him and I, and you'll get to listen to most of this here on the pod. So that's right here on the other side of this break or in the adjacent video, depending on where you're watching here. Speaking to 19-year-old right-hander Carson Milbrandt here on the official show. One of the top pitching prospects in this Marlins organization, and one who I'm really excited to follow his journey moving forward. So thanks for listening to what we do here on Fish Stripes. I'm Eli Sussman. Go Fish. Enjoy the interview. A special guest joins me here on the official show in the third round of the 2022 MLB draft. The Miami Marlins selected right-handed pitcher Carson Milbrandt out of Liberty High School in Liberty, Missouri. Milbrandt is working his way up through the Marlins minor league system. He's a member right now of the Jupiter Hammerheads starting rotation, projectable 19-year-old. He's trying to become the latest impact major leaguer to come up through this great Marlins pitching development pipeline. Thanks for taking the time to talk, Carson.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're talking right here on an off day. Before getting into you specifically, I wanted to get your reaction to a news just a few days ago. The Marlins called up Yuri Perez all the way from AA straight to the majors. He's only a year older than you are. I'm wondering what it is. What do you think when you see somebody that's almost your age already pitching important innings in the major leagues?
You know, it's crazy. First of all, he's an awesome guy. We reported January 15th for early camp. And he was there, and, you know, like, he obviously doesn't speak a lot of English, but it's like you can have conversations with him. But, like, it's so cool to just watch him, like, throw his bullpens or just honestly watch him go about his business. Like, he handles it very professionally. And, you know, you're watching him throw pens, and you're like, that guy's he's a major league pitcher. Like, he has all the tools. It's just – it's awesome to see. It's really cool.
Yuri, top prospect in this organization, and made – pretty impressive in his debut so far. So yeah, by the time this episode comes out, he'll probably be making his second start with the big league team too. Now, I mean, going back to you, there's a lot to cover here on you. Just going back to the beginning, do you remember how old you were when you became a pitcher and what it is that made you want to focus on that?
Yeah. So like, I honestly, when growing up, basketball was my main sport. I was all in basketball, but then obviously like, reality hit and I was a 5'6" point guard on the B team. So I was like, you know, basketball is probably not the way to go. But my freshman year, I got a few innings on varsity and I was like, you know, I really started to enjoy it. You know, I had a really good team, really good coaches my freshman year at school. So that ever since like freshman year, I'd say that's whenever I started to like, you know, I kind of realized I was better at pitching and just kind of worked on it then. And I really enjoyed it.
So it really wasn't that long ago relative to some of the other guys that were just coming out of the draft this past year. Is there any particular MLB pitchers that back then or even now that you try to pattern your game after that you think you have a lot in common with?
It was actually kind of funny. So like whenever I was in sixth grade with the Royals, from Kansas City, obviously, so watched a lot of Royals games. Johnny Cueto, that was kind of like, I loved watching him throw. I'd go to a lot of his starts whenever I think it was like sixth or seventh grade, but they won the World Series. And so like, I saw the parade, saw him, but it's actually really funny because it's the Marlins now. So I saw him at spring training and all that. And it was so cool to see that.
Yeah. You might see him around Jupiter sometime soon because he's in the middle of rehabbing an injury right now. Yeah, that is that is a funny coincidence with him. So a few years later, you made pretty rapid progress from that freshman year in order to become a really legit draft candidate right out of high school, but you were committed to go to Vanderbilt. We've talked to, there's been a bunch of guys in the exact same position that you're in that have gone on to have careers in the Marlins organization. Like half of them go to Vanderbilt. The other half, they get the offer they like and they turn pro right away. It's kind of 50-50, even guys in this organization that I've talked to. Could you just lead us through that whole decision process, you know, leading up to the draft and then, making the call to turn pro a couple weeks later?
Yeah, so my mom and my family is like very important to me and they're always, you know, usually ask for their opinion, but like this time they're just like, you know, pray to God and like whatever feels best for you, you go with that, like you go with that route. But I was actually at Vanderbilt for a week and a few days taking a summer class and before I flew home for the draft. So I got that taste of college, you know, moved into my dorm, really liked it. Vanderbilt was awesome. But and the indecision, you know, I got drafted. I really liked the number and just pulled the trigger on it. And I'm really happy I did.
Well, the thing that you mentioned there about already going to Vandy and taking the summer class is this has kind of been some of a controversy the last few years where they moved the draft date. It's a little later than it used to be. So it creates that awkward situation where, as you said, you're already like proceeding as if you might go to college and you don't know yet because the draft hasn't come yet. And now you get the reverse course and you're allowed to do that. I'm sure from your perspective and other guys you may have talked to, do you think it'd make more sense if the draft kind of moved back earlier the way that it used to be in June instead of pretty deep into July?
You'd think, because like it was super weird because I moved in and then a week later I literally moved out of my dorm. But like I was there with like Sal Stewart, Brandon Barriera, and other people that did the same thing that I did. So it's definitely weird for sure.
Yeah, it'd be easier selfishly from my perspective. They moved it to line it up with the All-Star events now on the calendar. And it's like everything is happening at once. And sometimes the draft gets buried underneath all the major league stuff just because they did that. I'm not a fan of it. Now, getting more to the technical part of it, your pitch mix, you have a pretty deep pitch mix for a guy that is relatively new to pitching and new to pro ball. Could you lead us through, you know, each of the different pitches that you have in your arsenal and the situations that you like to use them, how they kind of play off each other?
Yeah, so I got a fastball, curveball, changeup, and then sometimes my curveball moves like a slider. So people think it's a slider, but the whole time it's a curveball. But so like, and the mix kind of, you know, it's kind of new to me and it's kind of something new because you can't just go, you know, it's not high school. You can't just blow fastballs by people. Like, so I'm kind of learning how to use my pitches, but obviously like you have the fastball up, curveball down, or if like, it's kind of reading swings. So you'll like, a guy will foul a fastball back. You're like, oh, that guy's on it. Like, I probably shouldn't throw it again. So like slow down his bat with the changeup or speed up his bat with the changeup. So it's like, and our pitching coach's name is Dish. He does a really good job of helping me with that. So it's like, it's kind of new to me, but I'm slowly figuring it out.
Right. That's pitching coach Glenn Dishman out with Jupiter for people that aren't familiar with him. Yeah. From what I'm seeing, that fastball has been your primary pitch, using it maybe almost 2/3 of the time in the games that we've had tracked in Jupiter and in low A so far. Which of the individual pitches do you think would you call your favorite at this point? And is there any particular one that this season you're focused most on developing, improving, getting more consistent with?
Yeah, so it's got to be the fastball. I really love my fastball. I can place it pretty much anywhere I want, and I really like it. But we worked on my changeup a lot this spring training and early camp, and that's slowly becoming one of my like favorite pitches. It's just because it's kind of new, and whenever I throw like a good one, it's a really good feeling. Cause it's kind of like relief. You're like, oh, I've been working on that for so long. I just threw a good one, you know. So it just feels so good.
That's a specialty of the Marlins org. I'm sure you're aware of that, of guys developing them pretty quickly and becoming somebody like Sandy Alcantara. All of a sudden, it became his very best pitch last year when he broke out and won the Cy Young. Is a pitch they didn't even have when he was your age. There's a lot of examples of that, of guys like getting. They usually tell me that it's just a certain number of reps, right? After a while, you just throw it as much as possible, maybe play catch with it more often than you used to. And then eventually it just clicks. Is that what you're kind of figuring out?
Yeah. It's just like, so like I never really threw a changeup in high school. There's no reason to throw a changeup, but here it's So like the first week they had me here, had me pick out a grip. He was like, what feels comfortable to you? So just had my grip, and then yeah, just throwing it a ton. That's like the best way to develop it. It's just throw. It's like, it's, I threw it like all the time in spring training, and like they even tell you, they're like, I don't care if it's over the guy's head. I don't care if he hits it 500 feet. You know, you can't develop it if you don't throw it. So.
Gotcha. We're here with Carson Milbrandt here on the official show. It's getting back to your fastball, sitting about 94 so far from what I've seen in games this season, and more so than the velo, it's about the movement that you get on this pitch, both the late life that you have, both horizontally to the arm side, and then the way that it dips towards the ends. It's pretty terrific. Like, just, it just measures out pretty similar to a lot of major league caliber fastballs that we've seen out there, even as young as you are. Do you have any like theories as to why it is you get that great late life on it, that all of a sudden that great movement that you get, that is already serving you pretty good right now, but even moving forward, it gives you so much potential with that pitch?
Yeah, I honestly have no idea. I just kind of throw, it's like a normal fastball, but I do have huge hands. So some of like all my coaches have always said, like, you're like, the ball looks really small in my hands. So they could be the big hands. I honestly have no idea.
Interesting. Yeah, the hand size, that's something that comes up more when talking about football quarterbacks and the way that they grip it in that way. In baseball, yeah, it comes up. There are certain guys I know with off-speed pitches where if you have really long fingers, maybe that will help you. Yeah. But you think it's just your overall hand size?
I have no idea. If it's anything, I'd say it's hand size. It's just a normal four seam, but obviously, like, I've heard it spins really good and it's got good movement.
Got it. Now, talking about pitching at the low A level, the way that you're doing right now, I'm just curious about what it's like preparing for those starts and what it is that you're trying to achieve in those starts, because the goal is different than obviously the higher levels of baseball. It's prioritizing developments, whether more so than actually sometimes even more so than actually winning or losing the games. And you're also pitching at a level where it's hooked up to a lot of the same stat tracking that we get in the majors. So if you really want to, like, you could get all these details about the way that you're throwing the ball and the analytics behind that, and the same thing with all the opponents that you're facing. How much do you dive into those numbers when you're either preparing for a start or when you're like evaluating what you did after the fact?
Yeah. So before the start, I throw on Fridays. So first game of the series is Tuesday. So I watch three games and I book the game before I throw. So it's kind of like, I don't really dig into like the numbers that they're hitting, but you can kind of see it. But after, it's actually really cool, 'cause like, there is a lot of like data and stuff on my pitches throughout like the game. So that's really cool to see. And you can kind of see where it plays, like maybe why the guy hit this pitch, or maybe I shouldn't have thrown that pitch at this time. So that's kind of cool to see that stuff.
And aside from that, I noticed that you made your Jupiter debut, it was last September, and you were thrown to Cameron Barstead in that game. And for most of your starts this year, you were thrown to Barstead as well. He recently got moved up to high A. I'm wondering, from a pitcher's perspective, when you have a guy that you're familiar with, that you work with a lot, and all of a sudden you're working with a different catcher because of reasons kind of outside your control. How does that affect things, that having different, what is the value of that relationship right now? And like, how does it change when you have a different catcher all of a sudden responsible for you the next time out?
Yeah, obviously Barstad's awesome. He knows how to call a game. He's very good at what he does. He's really good behind the plate. And we were like, we'd go out to lunch or breakfast, you know, we'd hang out a lot. I had Sam Prider.
Yeah.
But it's kind of the same thing. It's like kind of a different build behind the plate, but they're both very good at what they do. And I like them a lot.
In terms of other things, such as your total pitch count, how many innings you're going to go, you're in an interesting spot where the team obviously wants you to develop as much as possible, but they understand that you're not used to throwing a certain number of innings. So for a season that started in April, and as you mentioned, you've been early camp started in January. Like, there's a certain limit, I guess, where by the end of the year, they want to make sure that you don't go too far. So is that stuff communicated to you in advance too? Like, how far you're allowed to go in this particular game, or do you just go as hard as you can until they say it's enough?
It's like five innings. They want you to go 5 innings or 75 pitches, but I've thrown more than 75 pitches. So you can kind of bend the line.
Awesome. Yeah. So that's Carson Milbrandt. He's going to be featured right in the middle of our upcoming Fish Stripes top 30 list of top prospects in this organization. Somebody that the numbers and the eye tests are like really trending in your way right now from what I've been able to see when you pitching in Jupiter. And I'm actually going to have some of my staff out there in Jupiter to cover some of the games. I think they're going to miss you. I think they're going to go on Jacob Miller Day on Saturday, okay, just because of the way that the schedule lined up. Okay. No, but this is really insightful, Carson. I appreciate you coming on with me. We're going to be keeping track of you super closely the rest of this year. Only 19 years old, and it's really exciting to have you in the Marlins organization. Thanks a lot for taking the time for this.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was awesome.
So I've been Eli Sussman here on the official show on the Fish on First podcast channel. Subscribe to us wherever you get your pods, and check out Carson if you're in the Jupiter area. Most of you are in the South Florida area. Just make the drive up. Plenty of available seats to see him pitch on most Fridays throughout this entire season. So that's going to do it for us. Go Fish.